This show furnished by Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn.
It's time for Gervy's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervy. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality, and television host, Kerry Kasem. Kerry brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervy and Kerry Kasem.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles. And everyone listening all over the world on KBC.com, I am Alan Gervy, and I am the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn. And today, as usual, I am here, right here in the beautiful studios in Culver City, California, to be the managing partner of your life. And here to manage your life is 1 year older, Kerry Kasem.
Oh, yay, yay.
You've aged a year since I saw you last.
I'm aging. Woohoo!
This was quite a week, wasn't it?
Oh, that's an understatement.
You had your birthday. Happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
And I know you did something wonderfully well for your birthday.
Good times with friends.
Well, yeah. I was talking about donating to Kasem Cares Foundation.
You donated, which thank you.
But not only that, I think that's a nice thing to do. And I think, you know, when we talk about Facebook, you have that opportunity to donate. We talked about Facebook last week about the ads, the political ads on Facebook and the boosting of the Facebook messages.
They let me boost my please donate to my foundation, Kasem Cares. They let me boost it. Yes.
Well, that gives us an idea. I think on Gervy's Law from now on, every post we will have a donation.
There you go. And then they'll let you boost it. That's right.
And it doesn't matter how political it looks, but they'll let us boost it.
That's right.
So you had a good time for your birthday.
Yes.
That's good. I'm happy to hear it.
Thank you.
Also in the news this past week, Brett Kavanaugh, of course, was nominated to the Supreme Court of the United States by President Donald Trump. And we are going to talk a little bit about that on this show. And later in the show, we have three really amazing guests who do such great work. I mean, when we talk about the homelessness, there's all kinds of issues, but special people work on behalf of people trying to help people. And three of our guests have done that, made a life out of it. Adam Murray will be on the show later on. He's executive director of Inner City Law Center, which is a pro bono nonprofit law firm who are protecting the most vulnerable individuals and families in LA, the homeless and others. And we also have Mark Rivick on the show, and he founded Venice Stakeholders Association, another nonprofit organization. He's co-chair at the Venice Neighborhood Council Ad Hoc Committee on Homelessness, so he has something to say about that. And leading off in the next segment, Gary Blasi, who is a professor of law emeritus at UCLA Law School, and he has done programs in public interest law and policy, and he will give his take on homelessness and some of the issues that are facing Los Angeles today. But first, we want to talk to Renee Landers. Renee Landers is professor of law at Suffolk University in Boston. She's a constitutional expert amongst other expertise. And Renee is going to talk a little bit about the nominee, Brett Kavanaugh, and what we can expect in the coming weeks. Welcome to Gervy's Law, Renee Landers.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's great to have you. Now, I've got to open up with an objection that I often do in court, in trials, and depositions, and it's objection calls for speculation. So let's get that objection out of the way right now, because the questions I'm going to ask you all will call for speculation. I know you don't have the magic answers. No one really does when we talk about a Supreme Court nominee and when we talk about his, in this case, background, whether or not we know what we can expect from him. But let's first start talking about the process. How do you see the process of the nomination going with Brett Kavanaugh? There's a lot said, partisan politics. Are we going to see partisan politics to the hilt, or are people actually going to listen to try and figure out whether he will be a good Supreme Court justice?
Well, I think that there will be an effort to try to get him to answer some questions about how he will approach the job of being a Supreme Court justice, how he sees that job as being different from the job he has now as a judge on the Court of Appeals, where, you know, he really has to uphold precedent. He has to follow Supreme Court precedent, and the Supreme Court justices have the opportunity to overturn precedents that they don't like for whatever reason. So really getting him to try to answer some of those questions, which he was willing to answer some of them when he was a nominee for the D.C. Circuit. But, you know, I think that it's a political process. Anytime you have the United States, you know, the president, a politically elected official, nominating a judicial candidate, and the United States Senate being involved in confirming that individual, it's inherently a political process. So I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing that politics are part of the process, because that's how the Constitution structured it.
You know, it's ironic that you say political process, because we had on the show not too long ago Brian Leiter, who says not only is the Supreme Court a political process in the nomination process, but it is actually a political forum. It is not a judicial, not justice, but it's politics, because people who are nominated and are on the Supreme Court have certain predispositions from a political perspective. You talked about precedent, and it's interesting when you talk about Brett Kavanaugh and his process, the nomination process through the D.C. Court, District Court. Yes, in that situation, when we talk about Roe versus Wade, which everyone is talking about, certainly he talked about precedent. You made a very good point when you talk about the Supreme Court not necessarily having to adhere to the precedent. Do you think that this is a smokescreen with when he says that he will follow precedent and perhaps he will have a different perspective? Again, I know I'm calling for speculation here, but from all accounts, does he feel potentially in Donald Trump's corner, having to maybe reassess Roe versus Wade being a nomination of Donald Trump?
Well, first of all, I think that no Supreme Court justice feels that they completely must adhere to the political agenda of the person that appointed them. I think that that would be very problematic for our justice system if that were the case. And you want them to, yes, they all come to the job with their own predispositions about the law and how the Supreme Court should decide cases and perhaps some policy judgments on some of the issues that they'll be presented with. But they do have to at least keep an open mind or address the factual variations or the way in which the issues come before them. So the way I see this playing out in the abortion situation is that, you know, it is a big step for the court to decide to overturn one of its precedents, and it did that in at least two cases this past term, but and they were cases of relatively long standing, and Roe v. Wade is now 45 years old, so that's a pretty long time to have a precedent on the
right
books. So it really, you know, there have to be some seriously good reasons for overturning a decision like that. Either the factual underpinnings of the basis for the decision have to have changed, the legal doctrine has made it kind of an outlier in the law. You know, there has to be some major shift.
Last I checked, a woman's body is still a woman's body, whatever the period
exactly
of time. So
and,
facts don't really change in that regard.
Exactly, all of those things. And also, Justice O'Connor wrote an opinion in the Casey case upholding, you know, basically following Roe v. Wade, saying that, you know, the public has come to rely in some ways on the legality of abortion in structuring their lives. So that's an important factor. So the way I see this playing out, to, you know, answer your question, the speculative part of your
right
question, is that I think that it's possible for the court to chip away at the availability of abortion by upholding state and federal law restrictions on the right without outright overruling Roe v. Wade. And I think that that's a more likely scenario than the court just deciding that it's going to suddenly overturn Roe v. Wade, because I think that institutionally for the court, that would be a kind of a cataclysmic decision.
Yeah.
And, you know, Chief Justice Roberts, for one, is interested in preserving the kind of public legitimacy of the court. And that would be kind of an undermining action, it seems to me.
There's a book called Freakonomics. Either of you read it? So Mark here, our other guest, is nodding his head. It was a book. I read it a few years ago. And it said that crime kept getting worse. Each decade, it got worse and worse and worse. The police didn't know what to do. The governments didn't know what to do. It just, they thought it was going to kind of take over. And as soon as Roe v. Wade passed, a decade to, you know, 2 decades past Rita, and then the crime kept going down and down, and they could not pinpoint what it was, except the only thing that they could think of was Roe v. Wade, but nobody would talk about it. Nobody would get on the news. Nobody would say anything. And this man really does break it down and show that because of, you know, Roe v. Wade, that less children were being, you know, dumped in orphanages or in gangs and it was very interesting. Do you have any opinion on that?
You know, I'm aware of the book, and I'm embarrassed to admit that I have not read it, but I'm certainly aware of that aspect of the book because I've heard it discussed and read about it. But I will say this, that there's a lot of talk generally in the political culture about respecting families and family values and all that sort of thing. But what I find is that there's a lot of talk about that in the abortion and even in the access to contraceptives context, which generally is aimed at restricting access to contraceptives, restricting access to abortion, and even restricting accurate sex education in schools. But there's not so much support for family values and things like, you know, living wages for working parents, child care, affordable child care for working parents, health insurance so that families, you know, can take care of their health needs in raising children. And this goes for the parents, too. You know, it takes healthy people to be healthy parents and healthy workers. And so there's a whole panoply of societal supports that are really important to having families and children who, you know, whose parents have enough time to pay attention to them and, you know, to raise them to be productive citizens. It just doesn't happen, you know, because you plop a child,
right,
you know, down the center of the street and, you know, they grow up and, you know, they're fine. That just doesn't work that way.
Right.
So I think it's a combination of a lot of things like that that help to make for raising children to become responsible adults.
Renee, I would agree with you there, and I'm not sure Brett Kavanaugh is going to have a whole lot to say about that, although certain things in civilization and society do change as a result of Supreme Court decisions. We don't have a whole lot of time, but I think one of the things that we can say about Brett Kavanaugh is, with respect to the Second Amendment and the Heller case, he will probably uphold that, and we can't necessarily see gun rights changing or limitations on guns changing too much given the setup of the court now if Brett Kavanaugh in fact is confirmed and nominated.
I agree with that. I think he wrote a dissent in a case that essentially upheld some registration requirements for semi-automatic rifles in the D.C. Circuit in the District of Columbia. And I think it was a ringing kind of endorsement of the Supreme Court's logic in the Heller case. And I don't see it getting any easier for gun control measures.
I would agree with that. Last question here for you, Renee. And again, it's calling for speculation, but I'm sure you will have an opinion on this. Will he get confirmed?
I think it's highly likely. I think that the speculation about people like Susan Collins,
right,
and Lisa Murkowski departing from the Republican fold on this vote I think that that's very misguided. I don't think that's going to happen. Is somebody like Susan Collins, who's from my neighboring state of Maine here, you know, has taken some votes in contradiction to the Trump administration, but I think she's voted to uphold almost every single one of his nominees to the courts. So she hasn't really departed from the Republican fold on those issues. And then I think that the Democrats have to choose, because I think that they have at least three Democrats in red states who will feel a lot of pressure to vote to uphold the president's, to confirm the president's nominee. And, you know, that might be a wise thing for the Democrats to do. Maybe that's a good political judgment for them to determine that they would prefer to try to gain control of the Senate,
right,
rather than block this one Supreme Court.
And I think you're right about that. I think with respect to Susan Collins, if there was any hostility shown to Roe versus Wade, that might sway her in the other direction. But I don't think we're going to see that through the hearings. Anything can happen. But certainly if things go the way that they seem they are going, he should be confirmed. Renee Landers, from Professor of Law at Suffolk University in Boston, I want to thank you for being on Gervie's Law today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thank
All right,
you.
Take care.
Right.
We got to take a quick break. We're going to talk homelessness after the break. You listen to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
My number two does not look like a number two. I don't know what to call it. Is there a number three?
Table for four, please. Anything close to the restroom.
A middle seat with these stomach problems? That's my fear of flying.
Sound like you? If it does, you could be one of the many people with a digestive condition called exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, or EPI. Even if you don't know what EPI is, you might know the symptoms. Frequent diarrhea, gas, bloating, stomach pain. If you have even just one of these symptoms, you could still have EPI, because not everybody experiences EPI the same way, which is why it's so important to open up to your doctor about all your symptoms. And the good news is, EPI is manageable, so don't keep a lid on it. Go to identifyepi.com, complete the symptom checker, and use it to have a conversation with your doctor. Don't keep a lid on it. Visit identifyepi.com. Brought to you by AbbVie.
My number two does not look like a number two. I don't know what to call it. Is there a number three?
Table for four, please. Anything close to the restroom.
A middle seat with these stomach problems? That's my fear of flying.
Sound like you? If it does, you could be one of the many people with a digestive condition called exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, or EPI. Even if you don't know what EPI is, you might know the symptoms. Frequent diarrhea, gas, bloating, stomach pain. If you have even just one of these symptoms, you could still have EPI, because not everybody experiences EPI the same way, which is why it's so important to open up to your doctor about all your symptoms. And the good news is, EPI is manageable, so don't keep a lid on it. Go to identifyepi.com, complete the symptom checker, and use it to have a conversation with your doctor. Don't keep a lid on it. Visit identifyepi.com. Brought to you by AbbVie.
If you plan to enjoy your lawn this summer, remember, so do bugs. Change their plans with Roundup Bug Destroyer from the Home Depot. And right now, save up to $20. Bug Destroyer kills over 100 kinds of insects, even grubs and ticks, and keeps killing for 3 months without harming the lawn. It's a long summer. Better plan accordingly. Right now, when you buy more, you can save more. Up to $20 on Roundup Bug Destroyer. Only at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. Selection varies by store.
Say no to rising prices. Amazon is raising its Prime membership price from $99 to $119 for free shipping. Walmart offers free two-day shipping with no membership fee. That's $119 back in your pocket. What would you do with it? Go to walmartfreeshipping.com for the chance to win a $119 Walmart gift card. That's walmartfreeshipping.com for complete rules and details. Walmart, two business day shipping. Minimum $35 order. Restrictions apply.
I just saved hundreds of dollars by switching to Geico. I'm as happy as a clam.
Disclaimer, Geico cannot guarantee you will be, quote, as happy as a clam, unquote. The Geico legal team cannot accurately verify clams even experience the complex human emotional state known as happiness. As an invertebrate mollusk living half submerged on the ocean floor, with no arms, legs, or wireless access, what's there to be happy about? A clam's all like, oh, I'm so happy I didn't get turned into New England clam chowder today. Pronounced regionally as chowda. Chowda. Oh, that's so fun to say. What were we talking about again?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more.
Hold everything for less. The Pack Store Save event is going on now at the Home Depot, and the shelves are full of smart moving solutions. Like moving boxes from as little as 69 cents, bubble wrap, moving blankets, packing tape, all in one place. Moving is stressful enough. Getting what you need in one trip shouldn't be. Make your first move to the Pack Store Save event going on now at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. Valid through August 22nd, U.S. only.
You're listening to Gervie's Law, giving you a new perspective to enrich your life. Now, here's your host, Alan Gervie.
Yeah, we're back right here on Gervie's Law. We're celebrating Carrie Kasem's birthday this week.
Woohoo! It's my birthday all week.
Oh,
I can,
wow.
I can celebrate aging. Yay!
You don't look old at all.
No, I
you
can't.
You look younger and younger, and you did that amazing... What
Botox
do you call it?
And filler and
no,
lasers?
I wasn't talking about the amazing Botox, filler, and lasers.
No.
That little piece you did on makeup and hair and everything like that. You look,
oh, thank you. Yeah, my photo shoot. That was very fun.
Yeah, that was great.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's amazing what social media does. I feel like I was there with you.
It was so much fun. I had like eight different looks, a full team. It was great.
Yeah,
I'll bring
the
magazine in when I get them.
You looked really young.
Yeah. Well, it really is due to all those things. You think I'm joking. People are like, women won't. I'm 46. So you don't look 46. Like,
no.
You don't look like this.
You look 26.
Right, unless you're doing all the lasers and the Botox and filler. And so, you know, if you want to look natural,
but not everyone can do all of that. Some people
find me
don't
later
have
show
the
you.
Resources.
You can
have
do this? No. I talk about how you can do this for very, very, very little money to a lot of money. To machines.
Carrie, I hate to put you in your place here, but some people don't even have homes.
That is true. Nice segue, Alan. Nice segue.
So we're going to talk about homelessness, and I'm sure, you know, we've got such a big problem with homelessness, and it's grown over the last several years in Los Angeles, and I'm sure that the people, unfortunately, don't have the options to be able to do filler Botox.
Probably not. That's the last thing you're thinking of when you don't have a home. I guarantee that.
Yeah. And, you know, there's so many issues. It's such a complicated thing. You know, people say, oh, I support anything we can do for homeless people, yet there's so many complications, and now Mayor Garcetti is facing some interesting advocacy from different sides about whether or not people who are sleeping out on the streets should be arrested. Is it a criminal act? What do we do with people who don't have homes? Do we have enough shelters? Should there be more shelters? And we're going to get a couple different perspectives this afternoon on this. And first, I want to welcome to the show Gary Blasey, who's at UCLA Law School, professor of law emeritus, been there for a while, and he teaches public interest lawyering courses. So this is something of public interest for sure. He's one of the founding members of the law school's David J. Epstein program in public interest law and policy. He's has a lot of experience with the homelessness problem as well as other public interest issues in the city. Gary Blasey, welcome to Gervie's Law.
Thank you. I look forward to speaking with you.
It's good to have you. First of all, let's start with the Jones versus Los Angeles case. A lot of people aren't familiar with the case, but it really is the cornerstone of what we're dealing with these issues.
Sure. Well, the Jones case was brought by the ACLU and another civil rights lawyer, Carol Sobel, and it stated the simple proposition that it's cruel and unusual punishment to send somebody to jail when they don't have any sort of a choice at all. And so the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal agreed with that and said that so long as there were so many more homeless people than there are places for them to legally sleep, it was unconstitutional to arrest them for that particular purpose. The case was eventually, while it was on appeal, it was settled to give some structure to that. So there is an agreement that's in effect and supposed to remain in effect until the city has constructed or caused to be constructed 1,250 units of housing for homeless people under very particular rules about what counts against the 1,250.
What would the argument be in court that the homeless person does not have the right? Is it basically because we're just trying to clean up the streets and we don't want the homeless there? Do we create criminal behavior because of that if they have no other options? Or what is the argument that there isn't enough shelters, there isn't enough homes for these people, and that is motivation to build or to put aside places where these people can be off the streets?
Well, the basic rule of law goes way back to English common law. It's what's called the necessity defense, and it basically says that there may be laws that under ordinary circumstances have to be observed and enforced, but violation can be excused if there's an absolute necessity. So someone lost in the woods who's starving to death can break into a cabin without being charged for a burglary if their only purpose is to get something to eat in order to survive. And then if you expand that principle up to a constitutional level, there's a basic substantive due process right to exist as a human being, and therefore you cannot criminalized behavior that people cannot avoid performing. So if you or I sat down on the sidewalk, we could be arrested, but that's because we have an alternative. And so when you think about someone who's homeless and you propose doing something in terms of making what they're doing illegal, you have to be able to respond to their question, where do you want me to go and what other option do I have? And the fact is, in Los Angeles, Unlike almost every other large city in the country, the overwhelming majority of our homeless people have no access to self-shelter. 75% of homeless people in the city of L.A. Lack shelter of any kind. So they're in cars and vans and RVs and tents and makeshift and just sleeping without any shelter at all on the street.
Now, what if there are actual shelters and they're tickets given to, or I shouldn't say tickets, like waivers, like, hey, here you can sleep here, we can pay for your hotel here, your motel here, and they're still sleeping on the streets, even though they have been given an option. Is that being enforced?
It is, and it will be enforced, but only if those options are real. Now, let me give you an example. So in the wintertime, we have a shelter system called the Cold Wet Weather Program, and you can get into various armories and other buildings for one night if you line up and if you're willing to give up everything you have greater than 1 cubic foot or more than will fit in a small bag. So, and that's just for one night. So, then you would have to line up again the next night, not knowing whether you're going to get in off the street. So if you have some makeshift arrangement that's giving you some minimal protection from the weather, it would be really irrational for you to give all that up in exchange for one night off the street and not knowing whether you're going to survive the next day. So it's still, you have to look at the details of the situation and at what the real choices are that homeless people have. And when you do that, there are obviously people who are unable to make rational choices because of the prevalence of mental disorders and mental illness on the street. But by and large, people are making the same decisions that you or I would make if we were in their position.
It's interesting because you mentioned sleeping in cars, and L.A. has banned sleeping in cars, but they let people sleep on the sidewalks. Why is there a distinction if people can sleep in a car or in some other vehicle, some other place, but we're okay? Well, not okay, but we're allowing them to sleep on the street.
Well, the city has modified that ordinance to some extent a couple of years ago. So now, at least in theory, there are places in the city where you can legally sleep in a car. And it's in areas that are predominantly industrially or commercially zoned. They're more than a block or 500 feet from any school or that sort of thing. And so there are some of those places. The difficulty is that unless you have access to the internet and really good research skills, you can't find out where those places are. So people end up parking illegally.
Right.
But in theory, they could park legally, and that's the city's defense to the lawsuits that would be brought under that. You know, but it's interesting that you raise that because I think most people are across most of the city are upset about the street encampments and tents, but they're actually about almost 60% of the people who are sleeping in some arrangement that they've created for themselves are sleeping in vehicles.
Yeah.
Only 40% are sleeping in tents and makeshift arrangements.
Realistically, when you talk about the tents and you talk about these little cities, and I was just, my birthday wasn't too long ago, and my two kids, 4 and 5 years old, said that they wanted to give their life savings to the homeless. So we went down to Skid Row and went and gave all of their money to the people there. And it was really an eye-opening experience for, I think, my kids. They'd never seen that before. There were so many people out there on Skid Row. We were right outside the L.A. Mission. How in the heck is that ever going to be cleaned up if that's what Mayor Garcetti has in mind with some changes based on the Jones versus L.A. case saying that perhaps there is or there will be enough places for people to sleep that is not on the street?
Well, under the rosiest scenarios that Mayor Garcetti and the City Council have put forward, they're talking about building about 10 or 15% of what's needed. The problem is that our society is generating homeless people at a faster rate than we can deal with. When the county and the city and their organization together, the Homeless Services Authority, did the big survey this year, they found that almost half of the people, 46%, were homeless for the very first time in their lives. So these are people who are coming from housing, and they've fallen out of the market. They're not long-term people, and they're local people. They're more likely to have been born here in in Southern California than people living in houses and apartments.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It's a dynamic situation. If we were just dealing with the people who are out there today, we could probably work our way out of this. But until we deal with the underlying issues of people's incomes and the cost of housing, we're going to be looking at this for a long time.
You know, you don't sound that optimistic. I think you're more realistic than anything. Not sure what will happen in the future, but certainly, as you've said, there are a lot of challenges that are facing this city. What would be your best guess at what will happen in the coming years?
Well, I think that'll depend entirely on long-term commitment by leadership in the city. And we really have not had that, in part because of the turnover and the political leadership that
right.
comes with term limits and just the workings of democracy. So most of our leadership has been basically trying to get out of the current situation looking not too bad for their next office. And I'm afraid that's sort of what we're looking at now. But if we had that leadership, we do know what to do. The big problem is that we haven't been doing that for the past at least a couple of decades. I've been working with people without housing and low-income tenants for 35 years, and Mayor Bradley was really the last mayor who had sort of a long-term perspective on these things. We can, if we begin to deal with the cost of housing and minimal amount of income that people
right.
have. We've got about 600,000 people in the county of LA living in households that are spending more than 90% of their income on rent.
Wow.
So all those people are just on the precipice,
about. When you're talking about 90%, that's horrific. How are people supposed to live? Well, Gary Blasey, I want to thank you for being with us. I'm not sure if you've cheered us up today, but certainly it's important. All the points you've made have been very important, something to consider. It opens people's eyes, I'm sure, just like my two little kids, their eyes were open when they saw those tents at Skid Row. Thanks for being with us today. Have a good day.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to talk a little more. We're going to get more in depth with this problem. We'll have Adam Murray and Mark Rajevic on with us after the break. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
Talk Radio 790 KABC News Update, sponsored by Pechanga. Whatever you love to do, you'll find more ways to escape, more ways to celebrate, and more ways to win at the all-new Pechanga Resort Casino in Temecula. I'm Steve Cumming. Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti says the Trump administration created its own immigration problems by enacting a so-called zero-tolerance policy that resulted in the separation of children from their parents at the border. Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen warned state officials today that the threat from Russia targeting U.S. elections has not dissipated. She spoke at the summer conference of the National Association of Secretaries of State in Philadelphia. And an Oregon woman who disappeared a week ago was found alive at the bottom of an oceanside cliff in Big Sur, where she survived in the wreckage of her SUV by using her radiator hose to siphon water from a nearby creek. 22-year-old Angela Hernandez of Portland injured her shoulder but was able to walk and talk. KABC SoCal weather, sunny this afternoon with highs from the mid-70s to around 80 at the beaches to the mid to upper 80s inland. More news coming up and continuous coverage on KABC.com. I'm Steve Cumming, Talk Radio 790, KABC News.
Norm's Baby Back Ribs are back for just $12.99. Flame-grilled baby backs, crispy chicken tenders, creamy coleslaw, hot fries and soup and salad just $12.99. For limited time at Norm's Restaurants.
Do you care about sex, addiction, mental health, social issues like the Me Too movement, and getting healthy? Tune in to Dr. Kate and Lauren for the provocative new show, Behind Closed Doors, Saturdays at 6 p.m. on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
If you have to call a plumber, why not call one who shows up on time and smells good? Like Mike Diamond, the Smell Good Plumber, at 1-800-446-MIKE. Or you can always book your appointment online at MikeDiamond.com.
The workplace is a soap opera of relationships, rules, and labor violations. Hear about it Sunday evenings from 7 to 9 on Carl Gerber, Workplace Lawyer, right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Every home is unique. That's why I, the Orkin Man, rely on science.
Mom! Ork is here!
Hi, we have a rodent problem.
Rodents do like to find a comfortable home, and even if you get rid of them once, they're great at finding their way back in.
Mom! Soda!
Especially if there's a good source of food.
And a slice of pizza!
But using the latest research and exclusion techniques, I'll customize a treatment for your home that'll send them packing.
Don't forget the ranch this time!
We still talking about rodents?
Orkin. Pest control down to a science. Visit Orkin.com for a free estimate.
Say no to rising prices. Amazon is raising its Prime membership price from $99 to $119 for free shipping. Walmart offers free two-day shipping with no membership fee. That's $119 back in your pocket. What would you do with it? Go to WalmartFreeShipping.com for the chance to win a $119 Walmart gift card. That's WalmartFreeShipping.com for complete rules and details. Walmart, two business day shipping. Minimum $35 order. Restrictions apply.
Hey, you like free stuff, right?
Yeah.
Well, KABC is on a mission to hook you up with tickets to the hottest concerts, comedy shows, movie premieres, theme parks, restaurants, gift cards, cash books, DVDs, hats, t-shirts, fans, money, DVDs, well, pretty much anything that we can get our hands on.
Gimme.
But it's four. Hang on a second. Four. You can get your hands on these cool prizes. There are a couple of rules.
KABC on-air contests are open to legal U.S. residents age 18 or older at the time of entry who reside in Los Angeles, Orange, San Bernardino, Riverside, or Ventura counties.
Employees of Cumulus Media Holdings Incorporated, its parent company, affiliates, related entities, and subsidiaries, promotional sponsors, prize providers, advertising agencies, other radio stations serving the listening area, and immediate family members and household members of all such employees are not eligible to participate.
Listeners may only win once every 30 days. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Limit one entry per person unless otherwise stated.
Winners are responsible for all taxes associated with any prize. For prizes valued at over $600 in any calendar year, winners will be issued a 1099 form. No transfer or substitution of prizes.
Prizes may not be redeemed for cash, auctioned, or sold, and must be claimed by the winner at the station during normal business hours with valid U.S. ID. Once notified, prizes must be claimed within 30 days and a release signed, or prizes forfeited.
A complete copy of the rules can be obtained at the offices of any radio station owned and or operated by Cumulus Media Holdings Incorporated or by visiting KABC.com/contest-rules.
You've heard of Murphy's Law, but have you heard of Gervie's Law? Anything that can go wrong can be made right. Now, here are your hosts, Carrie Kasem and Alan Gervie.
Yeah, we're back. Carrie's looking happier now. Why are you looking so happy?
This music.
Oh, it's the music. Because I guess last segment I mentioned that it was your birthday this week and you were feeling old. Then you heard the music. But that music's from a long time ago. You've got to be pretty old to remember that.
Yeah, because I am. I've got one foot in. You're throwing some dirt.
That's not true. That's not true at all. You got your whole life ahead of you.
Yeah.
It's just starting.
Oh, right.
And we're not going to talk about your Botox or anything like that.
No,
because,
why not?
Well, because you offended a lot of homeless people.
That is not true. That is not true at all. I don't think anybody that's homeless, maybe they're listening.
They listen on the radio. I mean, certainly there's a lot of people that have just been down on their luck. It's tough out there. What Professor Blasey was saying is that some people, 90% of their income is put into their homes.
I know.
At Disneyland, there's a dispute with the workers, and there are so many Disneyland employees who are homeless. It's amazing to think that in this day and age, people who are working can't afford homes.
Disney needs to make affordable housing. They should make affordable housing for their workers.
There are a lot of things in the negotiation process with the Disney workers and the unions, but that'll be something that we'll find out as time passes. First of all, let's talk to Mark Rajovic. He's been sitting here very patiently.
Yes, he has.
In studio.
But I got to talk to him before you came in. We had a whole conversation.
He really is an authority. When we talk about Venice and Santa Monica, we were just talking about during the break how he spent most of his life living in the area, went to UCLA, so that's close by. He's an activist. He founded Venice Stakeholders Association, which is a nonprofit organization. He has a keen interest in public policy and government. He's co-chaired the Venice Neighborhood Council Ad Hoc Committee on Homelessness. So he's very in tune with the issue, especially as it relates to Santa Monica and Venice, which, you know, people ask, why are there so many homeless people in the area? And I think the easy answer, Mark, is it's a really nice area to be in if you're going to be homeless.
It's actually quite a magnet, particularly in Venice, when you combine the fact that L.A. has basically stopped any enforcement against occupying sidewalks or the beach. I was walking by there this morning, and there are quite a few tents now out on the sand. So you take
right on the beach?
Yes.
Really?
And you take away any enforcement, and then you add to that the fact that some of these folks are attracted to drugs and use drugs, and it's a big drug emporium all along the boardwalk there. It's also a great opportunity to panhandle, particularly to a lot of visitors and Europeans, for example, who aren't used to homeless populations other than maybe the Roma, the gypsies. And they're sort of an easy mark for people asking for money for food. And then you combine the fact that it's a lovely environment to live outside in. I remember early on when I was getting into studying this issue, and a couple homeless people showed up at one of our meetings, and we were interviewing them and talking with them.
Yeah.
And, you know, the guy could have been on welfare in Chicago, but it was winter. And he said, gee, I'd much rather be here in winter. And as much as I have great respect for our previous
guest,
Gary, in Venice, we turn the numbers, I think, upside down when it comes to who's from L.A. and who's from out of state. The former executive director of the Teen Project, which operated right on Windward Avenue and focused on the 16 to 24-year-old homeless population, he said that in his estimation, over 70% of the population of that population was from out of state. A lot of young travelers and a lot of people that would turn down any offers of housing. And they said, I'm not homeless. I could go home to Madison, Wisconsin, back to Portland. I am traveling generally with my little tribe.
And living on the streets.
And until we return to a more disciplined approach and answers the question that came up in the Jones settlement that Gary was talking about by offering, before we enforce the no sleeping on a sidewalk law, a credible offer of housing, that we offer them a motel voucher, we offer them not the current winter shelter bed. And he was right. Many of the homeless don't want to go into the existing winter shelters because they're only at night. You can only take a small bag of things. You can't go with your partner. You can't go with your dog. They need to change that model to make it a credible offer where we'll give you an offer of someplace, maybe not 600 square feet, but maybe 200 square feet. Maybe the bathroom won't be in the room. It will, or attach the room. You got to walk down the hall like I had to do in the fraternity I went to at UCLA. So we need to come up with different models, make those offers. And from that, we can, I hope, provide both the nudge for people to get off the street. Those that really don't want housing can simply move on.
Well, you say simply move on, but aren't you talking about criminalization or some enforcement? Because it sounds good, what you're saying right now. We're going to give alternatives to these people. But you even said it yourself, that a lot of them aren't interested in those alternatives where probably they should be. So aren't you going to have to force their hand?
You absolutely will. But if you have met the constitutional requirement of providing a credible offer of housing, then you are not engaged in cruel or unusual punishment. You're just getting a kid that needs to probably go back home to Portland, Oregon to go, or at least to move on and get off of our sidewalks, which are simply easements over public property, and that, frankly, should never have been given over by the city as part of that settlement, because frankly, it wasn't theirs to give. All they have is an easement. You're an attorney. I guess you don't do property law.
No, I don't.
But basically, the city has an easement that prevents the property owner from building on the sidewalk or parkway, requires them to maintain it, and leave it open for passage. Well, these encampments generally deny passage and defeat the whole purpose for which that easement was entered into with the property owner. And we have long argued that there's a takings a legal challenge, because the city doesn't have a right to give this property to someone else for, in this case, habitation.
You know, I get a ticket when my car sticks out a little bit over the sidewalk. Really. This is no joke. I have to make sure my car is in.
Well, the new car. The old car wasn't the problem.
That's true. The old car fit. The new car, I'm like smashing it into my garage just to make sure I can get it over the sidewalk.
So, right. You can't block the sidewalk.
But somebody else can. I agree with you. If there is housing and they should, people should be able to bring their pets, period. I don't care. A pet is a child, you know, it's a furry little child, at least in my book. You have a pet, that becomes your child. So if you're not being able to take your animal with you, I can understand people not wanting to go into the shelters. That makes sense. But if these laws change and if we have proper housing for people and these people just say, I have a sidewalk, those people should be asked to leave. But if there is no proper housing, there is nowhere to stay. Okay, I get it. But when you have proper housing, those laws should be enforced and enforced to the maximum. Because other people, you know, when you buy a home, you don't, and you have, I live in Sherman Oaks. The population, the homeless population has grown immensely. I know. I see them all the time. I know some of them by name. I say hi. But it's growing and growing and growing to where there are people on the end of my street sleeping in tents. Or there's a couple guys that every single morning walk by because there's a restaurant down the street. I don't know if they get free food, but it's constant. And if these people had a place to stay, I bet they would go. I don't think they'd be sleeping at the end of my street.
What about the resources that, we have available through the police and enforcement? How is that going to put a strain on the activities, I know it already does, of the police and of holding centers or anything of that nature? A lot of these people don't have the wherewithal to take care of themselves. And I think Carrie's talking about some of them. I'm sure you see it all the time in Venice. And a lot of people are fearful. Maybe they shouldn't be, but they are fearful of certain people who have mm-hmm. either mental illness or drug problems.
Look, they have good reason to be fearful. And it is a travesty that the society over the last 40 years has allowed the situation to develop. In part, not just for the dehumanizing effect upon all those on the street, but the danger that it poses to those, the rest of us in the society. The shooting that was at the Surfside restaurant on Windward about 2 months ago, which was a macho beef between two people. The ownership, the management said, you know, get out of here, take your argument outside. They continued the argument. Guy pulled a gun and killed the other fellow. That guy was living in the encampment a block away on Grand by the post office.
The guy who killed him?
The guy that killed him was living there. And that's only one of the many incidents that I've documented or seen over the last 15 years, because within the population anywhere of homeless people are people that are lethal and that people that will act out, people that will either they go off because they're mentally ill or because they are taking certain drugs that triggers them to go off, and they become assaultive, they become enraged. So that, but let me come back to your question about the resources of the police. It is frightening how few LAPD officers are on the street at any one time. So I appreciate that there's always a concern about diverting them, but to deal with this issue. But they'll also tell you that in Venice, in particular, most of their calls have to do with the homeless, and that to the extent that the more we can move them into housing or employ family reunification, which was done very successfully by a couple of pastors in Venice, the Wellers, Regina and Steve Weller. They moved over 400 people over several years off the street, and many of them, they reconnected with family members who the homeless person felt was safe and felt comfortable going home to. And then my organization, in some instances, and other donors gave them the funds for bus tickets We provided meal vouchers so that they have something they could eat on their way home. And we were sending people back to El Paso, Texas, and back to Pennsylvania, and back to Illinois.
We're getting rid of all of them.
But it's not getting rid of them. It's saving them.
I just want to ask you, you know, you said our organization, Venice Stakeholders Association. Tell us a little bit about them and what they have done. And I know they've done a lot of positive work as a nonprofit organization. But, you know, when you talk about, you know, sending these people back, is that a positive thing? You're saying that in a good way, that you're reunifying them with family and with opportunities to work?
There's a payoff on both sides. Often these are younger people and they are simply decaying, on the street. There's unlikely they've, like the fellow that, the police shot in front of the townhouse. Also on Windward, it seems a lot of stuff that's really negative happens on Windward over the years.
I think Jim DeSimone, a lawyer who's been on the show quite a bit, represented the family.
That young fellow had family. He could have gone back to family. He had a son, I believe, estranged from his wife. He came out here to be an artist, and he ran through his funds. He started couch surfing, and then he started living on the beach, and he just completely got into alcohol. And that is what created the ugly confrontation that resulted in his being shot. There is no future for almost everybody that comes out here without a contact, without a family member, without ample resources, or with some license, skill, something or other. So that yes, you could say, yes, we're just getting rid of them. But is it better for them to decay on the street and their health to deteriorate, their mental situation to deteriorate, or for what these two pastors were doing? This wasn't my program. These are two people of the cloth,
right,
who found that was the quickest way they could move these young people into a safe environment where they did have an opportunity for education, for a job, and they were, I think, fairly rigorous about making sure that there was a path, and even checking ahead, you know, checking in the future over, you know, every month, calling to make sure that John or Bob or Mary were doing okay. But back to I want to make the comment about the police. They're getting the calls and spending the time on this audience anyway, and they're also, the calls are coming from residents who are in some way in danger or at risk or have been attacked or there's been a break-in or increasingly we see car windows being broken. And the same officers could be spending the time combined with, as Santa Monica does, with social workers who have now access to housing. They have access. There's $435 million available in Measure H funds, in part to pay for housing vouchers or motel vouchers, and those need to be presented with the police officers who know these and have gotten to know these people on the street into credible offers of housing and the nudge of, we're going to close down this particular encampment.
Yeah, well, that's important.
We're going to close down the encampment, and yet we're going to give everybody a path to a bed, to a shelter, or to shared housing. There's this very marvelous couple in Venice, Heidi Roberts and John Betts. They studied the issue. They got involved in it. Heidi went off and volunteered at PATH, people assisting the homeless in Hollywood. And
are these a really famous Venice couple? There's they're black and white?
No, they're not black and white.
Okay. There's another one.
This is a gray area right now.
No, but maybe it's them, but there's a very famous couple.
Well, they were written up, but they were on the front page of the LA Times,
maybe,
I think.
Yeah, there's that one, and there's another one too, but you know them if you want.
Doug Smith's article on what they'd done. They bought two, I think, 10 or 14 unit apartment buildings, and they did it with a group called Share Inc. And they basically created dormitory style where two people are in each room. And they've sort of overnight, you know, housed 40 people or something. Wow. And they are all, and they're actually still making money because all of them have some kind of funding. They can get a voucher. They have SSI, you know, supplemental Social Security. Some way they're getting about $500 a month from each person. And that's where the county and the city have to go to, or they are going to run out of money.
Yeah.
And never be able to catch up with the number of homeless.
We are running out of time as you talk about running out of money. I feel bad that Adam Murray, who we talked about was going to be on the show, the executive director of the Inner City Law Center, couldn't make it. Apparently he got stuck on an airplane. Hopefully the airplane has landed. He was supposed to be on the show today. He may have had a different perspective than you, Mark, in what you've said, and I'm sure with the work that he's doing with the pro bono law firm, a 30 attorney firm, he may have had something to say about some of the issues that you brought up. But we'll have to wait for another day on that one. Mark Rajovic, I want to thank you for coming on to Gervie's Law. Some interesting stuff. It's a tough, tough problem. And hopefully they can make some headway. All the folks can put their heads together and address the problem that work for everyone so that the homeless have opportunities and the people who are concerned about the homeless also, their interests are taken care of. Speaking of interests, thank you, Carrie. Your interests were certainly taken care of this week with your birthday, and
well,
I know
they
you
were.
Had a
and
good
you,
time.
You know, and thank you for your gift. I really appreciate it. Very sweet.
Your gift is being here with me. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll see you next week.
This show furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.